Welcome to the Air Force Doctrine Podcast. My name is Nicholas Underwood. On this episode, I had the extraordinary opportunity to sit down with General Anthony J. Cotton, Commander, U.S. Strategic Command. Our conversation explores the challenges of peer competition, integrated deterrence, the mission of U.S. STRATCOM, and the importance of relationships. Please join us. General Cotton, thank you so much for being here today. This is an incredibly humbling experience for you to take your very busy schedule and give it to the Doctrine Center here and to our audience at large. So thank you so much.
No worries at all. It's great to be back at Air University.
Yes, sir. Good to have you, sir. We'd like to get kind of right into it. And as any discussion, we'll start by kind of defining our problem, and then we'll get into some of the more detailed questions. So we hear a lot these days about peer competition, great power competition. And beyond kind of the simple mathematics on that, equal size militaries, economies, in your view, what is peer competition? What is great power competition? How are you seeing this environment in front of us?
Yeah, no problem. I think the way you have to define that is, for the first time since the advent of a nuclear weapon, the United States and our allies and partners are facing a challenge that we've never faced before. And that challenge is two near peers that have the capability of having parity, if you will, and we'll define what parity means later. I think it's more than weapons on weapons. But PRC and Russia, if you think about where they are today, it's a lot different than our predecessors, and it's going to be different for every man and woman as far as that's wearing a uniform in the future, what they're going to have to deal with.
The environment itself, you've made a reference to history, but the environment itself has changed quite a bit as well. Are you seeing a difference there in terms of the domains and et cetera?
Yeah, so we talk about the fighting domains, the expansion of, I have what I consider more than just a nuclear role. I am long-range fires from a strategic deterrence perspective. I'm responsible for kinetics that are conventional or nuclear. I think another piece that's pretty interesting in this domain is, if you really kind of think about the geopolitical environment that we live in, it's a lot different than the Cold War era, if you will. The interlocking between the economics of what we would call a pacing challenge of an adversary like PRC. Think how we're interlocked economically with what the PRC offers the United States, allies and partners. That wasn't the case if you really think through us going through the Cold War era. When we went through the Cold War era, it was actually a little more simplistic. Because when you went through the Cold War era, you had the Warsaw Pact and you had the West. Self-sufficient on both ends of that spectrum. The Warsaw Pact was self-sufficient. The West was self-sufficient. We didn't want to deal with the Warsaw Pact, and we didn't buy any materials from the Warsaw Pact. We weren't economically intertwined with Warsaw Pact nations and the former Soviet Union whatsoever. Fast forward to where we are today. Not only are we intertwined economically with adversaries, we're actually, our allies and partners are also intertwined. So it makes the decision space and decision calculus a little different than it was in the past.
Yes, sir. I don't think anybody's really explained, at least not to me, the complexity there. It's easy to look at the numbers, just two adversaries. But when we look at the complexity of the environment, I think that is, it really helps me understand exactly what we're facing. One of the things that comes out really clear in the national security strategy, national military strategy, is a lot of discussion on integrated deterrence.
Yes.
And so the word integrated in joint doctrine has morph to kind of explain the previous colloquial whole of government. How does your command interpret integrated deterrence, integrated at large, and then how can airmen, soldiers, sailors, Marines at lower levels really understand this concept? Because it is a big discussion.
Yeah. This, sir. I describe it two ways, right? I think integrated deterrence, there's a down and in description, and that can be for folks in the audience as simple as understanding what are the relationships amongst major commands, what are relationships between combatant commands, et cetera, within the Department of Defense. I think it's still down and in when you talk about it from the whole of government, from the United States, on what that relationship looks like between the Department of State, Department of Commerce, Treasury, Department of Defense, the old dime concept, right? But much less stovepiped. And then there's an up and out definition of integrated deterrence for me. And for me, I think that's the one that I've been really concentrating on when we talk about allies and partners. And what I mean by that is, let's start with the up and out. I just returned from UCOM and had a great visit and a warfighter talks with the UCOM commander, General Chris Cavoli, and his team there in Stuttgart. And one of the things we kind of described in our trip in Europe, which actually started at Brussels, when I had the opportunity to actually speak at NATO to the military committee. And actually, that was actually subject of, this, of the conversation. It was, how can you play in my portfolio and still not really carry nuclear weapons if you're not a nuclear nation, but still support the mission of STRATCOM and strategic deterrence? I described it in terms of, if you really think about integration and you think about conventional nuclear integration and you think about how you integrate all of that together, it can be something as simple as, what is something that your nation is unique and at the top of their game on, right? It could be non-kinetic effects. It could be kinetic effects that are conventional. How can you support me in all the domains? But how can you support me, for example, like in logistics? You know, can you provide maybe a A400 T-tail transports instead of us using C-17s that we can maybe use in another reason or rationale? The same with tanker support for the bomber forces that might be needed. I got people going kind of up and down and saying, uh-oh, okay, that's a whole different thing than what they were thinking initially with my portfolio and the rationalization of, yeah, but we're not a nuclear nation, so we don't understand how we can actually be a part of this. But then they got a better understanding. The same can be said when we were in Indo-PACOM. Because at Indo-PACOM, my first visit was on the Korean Peninsula, and we spent a lot of time with the ROC. And it was hosted by USFK General Paula Camera. And what we talked about there is, there's no need for the Republic of Korea to go nuclear because we provide, you know, assurance and extended deterrence as the United States because you're one of our allies. And we kind of showed them, but here's some things that you could do to provide that support and not have to go nuclear and be a nation that owns nuclear weapons. And then, you know, we ended that trip with a trip to Japan, and the same type of things was conversed there in the conversations that I had with the Minister of Defense, as well as the Chief of Staff of the Defense Forces. And it was a bright light that just kind of shone on them that said, you know, we didn't think about it from that perspective, but now as we kind of think through it, we can see how we can actually integrate a little better across all facets of life for them, whether it's their commerce, whether it's their equivalency of the Minister of Foreign Affairs or et cetera, et cetera. So I think it's finally landing. Right? I call it dime on steroids, right? So if you think about the dime construct, which everyone else should understand dime, if you think about the dime construct in itself was a little stovepipe by definition. I think integrated deterrence kind of cut that off and look at it horizontally as well as vertically. That's simple on what I see integrated deterrence to be.
There's something very interesting that you've kind of dovetailed in here. The idea of opening the aperture on what is deterrence. Even in our own doctrine, deterrence discussions are generally in the nuclear realm. And I think that comes from a lot of the literature that came after World War II. But deterrence is a much larger, it's not based on a simple weapon system. There's a lot more talking there. And you mentioned earlier you wanted to get a little bit into parity here. And it seems like you started to. I want to give you an opportunity to talk a little bit of what you mean by parity.
By definition, I never look at where we are as a fighting force in regards to one nuclear nation or now two with the rise of the PRC and what we're going to see as far as what they have as their nuclear arsenal. You know, they are a full-fledged triad, and we understand that now. I always get questioned on, so what does nuclear parity mean, right? Because then that sometimes dovetails and are we turning this into an arms race? No, I'm not. What we're really talking about here is my ability to understand the objectives of the President of the United States, and how do I get the effects I need to meet those objectives? So by definition, we know now that we have not one nation that we have to make sure we cover and hold at risk, but now we have two. And actually even more than that in the geopolitical environments that we're in now. So I don't think it's a weapon for weapon conversation. It's an effect-based conversation on how I can be able to garner the effects that the president is asking, in which we compel our adversaries because it's about course of action, right? And how do you delay or have them recognize that that course of action, what that result will be? And then by definition of deterrence, benefit of action, undesired results, and make it so they recognize that the results that you will receive is probably not worth the benefit of the action.
Yes, sir. Let's get a little bit into StratCom specifically. I think what's very interesting, at least from the doctrine point of view, is StratCom is called a functional command as opposed to the typical geographic command the average airman is a little more familiar with, such as CENTCOM. But as we look at a functional command, it's not as easy to draw the boundaries.
There aren't any. I mean, that's just by definition, right? Myself, Space Command.
As I, research this podcast, I'm going, wow, this is a large scope. And so the question is simply, how does that change how your command sees problems and how you approach solutions with this larger viewpoint?
Yeah. So I think, to be frank, it's pretty basic on where it starts. It starts with the relationships, and it does start with the relationships of the geographic combatant commands. But I do have the opportunity to be a supporting or supported commander. Right. It all depends on what the objective is and what the effects are that we're trying to achieve. So I think fundamentally what's really, really important is our relationships. And what does our relationships look like with the GCCs? I just mentioned that we just got back from Europe and we just had a warfighter talks that we haven't had since 2021 with EUCOM that I thought was very fruitful and very beneficial. So we wanted to make sure that there's no light between us in understanding on if there's something that was to happen in his theater and hopefully what we can do to prevent escalation and make sure that when we come together as two combatant commanders in regards to trying to figure out what the solutions we want for that AOR to be, that there's no light between us. There's going to be times where I'll be the supporting commander. There will be times where I'll be the supported commander, even in his AOR. And the same can be said with Admiral Aquilino in the Indo-Pacific Theater. There's times where I am the supporting commander for his conventional fight, but he will then be the supporting commander to me as a supported commander if that was to escalate into something different. So those relationships are incredibly important.
That's interesting, sir. That's the evolution we're seeing in what's coming out of Joint Doctrine out of the J7 office. They're talking a lot about any possible future conflict being full of both supporting and supported relationships across all the combatant commands. And it has a lot to do with what you described as the environment, the complexity, the interconnectedness of the entire global landscape. And so we are definitely seeing those changes in doctrine.
Well, I mean, global force management that's done by the Joint Staff and global force employment, former Chief of Staff of the Air Force, who's now our chairman, truly understands that because as a former Chief of Staff of the Air Force assets are stretched every way from Sunday. And he understands that when you talk about how do you get the effects that might be called upon from the Department of Defense, you have to do that in a global force employment regime, right? So you have to kind of figure out what you can be able to handle and how you can allocate the resources to get after the fight. And it's got to be a joint fight. And let me add, it has to be a joint fight that also includes allies and partners.
For that integration piece, you talked a lot about at the command level. Thinking about myself as working on a staff, it would seem prudent for me to also build those relationships among the COCOMs at my level as well. Would that be decent advice, sir?
Yeah, but I mean, to be frank, I think at the unit level, you don't have to go that high to say that you want to build integrated relationships at the combat command level. I'll be frank, I think, especially as airmen, you can build that relationship. If you're at a MAJCOM headquarters, why not build that relationship with fellow MAJCOMs across the nation and the world?
So what are some, for your command specifically, what are some of the challenges that you're facing and how are you kind of getting after those? In your
Let's see, the challenge I'm facing, we started off by saying, first time since the advent of nuclear weapon, we have two nuclear near peers. I'm the only combatant commander right now that has every platform and every weapon system that's under modernization, right? So all three legs of the triad is being modernized right now. For the airmen out there, two legs of that triad belongs to the United States Air Force. The third leg belongs to the Navy, right? So none of this is cheap. None of this is going to be turned on a dime. So one of the biggest challenges that I think we will face here for probably the next two decades until the last weapon system is put in place is the fact that we're going to have to manage transition from legacy systems to modernized systems without any hiccups, without any gaps, et cetera, et cetera.
That's interesting, sir. So being in this transitory phase, I think airmen are feeling the tension of meeting a lot of the challenges, a lot of the changes, and it's just more to come. What advice are you giving your command in order to deal with that inherent tension, that being comfortable with being uncomfortable?
I think you answered that question. I
mean, yes, sir.
No, but all kidding aside, I think we are going to have to figure out how do you saddle up to understand that there's always going to be a tension. As a wing commander, I always tell folks, I'd much rather, and I use an analogy of tension on a string. I always want to make sure that the folks in my wing understood that there's a little tension on the string. Because I said, what happens is you can actually pull on the string if there's already a little tension, and the wing will be incredibly successful because there's an expectation on, what is to come, and it's not easy work. If there's slack in the string, and then all of a sudden, there's something that pops up that is going to be pretty challenging for the wing, and you can insert wing for anything you would like, then what happens? There's a 50-50 chance that when you pull, it's going to actually snap, right? And what I mean by that is that the men and women within the wing, the squadron, the flight, is not going to be able to meet that challenge. So always having a little bit of tension, I think, is always good. And I think the reality is, the men and women of the department are going to have to understand that literally is where we are in this world today with the challenges that we're seeing in the geopolitical environment.
You started getting into a little bit of this, sir, but it's been said many times that the innovative spirit and professionalism of our force is really our competitive advantage. And with your string analogy there, we're leaning heavily on our force. Do you think that beyond getting comfortable with being uncomfortable, is there certain gaps in our knowledge that we need to address as a force that we need to go after either at a professional syllabus level or individual
type? Yeah, that's a great question. And I think right now, I think the realities of what we're seeing, I don't like saying back to the future, but you hear a lot of people talk about back to the future. I don't like using Cold War. I don't like saying the term Cold War. But the realities is that right now, most of us that are active duty, regardless of branch of service, don't understand what it means to have an adversary that is of equal on par with you. Right. For the last almost three decades, that hasn't been the case. Right. So air dominance, never a factor. Air superiority, not a factor. The electromagnetic spectrum, domination of that or use of that, not a factor. Right. So now when you think about it, and when you think about electronic warfare, for example, didn't really have to think about it in the last 25 years with the threat vectors that we had back then. All those come back into play because we're talking about, great power competition to how you opened up the podcast with, right? So it's a different adversary. And that adversary is not changing, probably, unfortunately, in a lifetime of service for the folks that are listening right now.
Yes, sir. So the whole knowledge then means we have to understand that strategic environment and really get out there and try to understand the problem. A lot, like you talked about, the evolving domains, EMS, and just how much different this is. It's basically not business as normal, and what's worked in the past doesn't necessarily mean it's going to work in the future.
Right.
It's my words.
You're absolutely right. I think that's going to be key for us. I think there's always lessons learned on everything we do, even in the domains of the fight we had, the CENTCOM AOR fights that we had in the past. But that's a different fight than the conflict that we might see in the future. So as long as folks understand and learn the best, get the best lessons learned out of that, but then I think you're correct. We might have to go back to the books to understand what strategic strategies were when you had near peers. That used to be a term we used to use earlier, right? We used to talk about conflict with near peers. Right now, it's great power competition with adversaries that are on par with us with their capabilities.
Yes, sir. In the past, you've talked a lot about, I have a quote here, about cultivating the next generation of not only STEM, but also electricians, welders, and technicians. And you were talking in a much broader sense, not necessarily about the force, but us as a country. And so I always wonder, our military men and women are both service, but they're also citizens of this great nation. And we talk about what we used to call multiple capable airmen and now mission-ready airmen. How can we better integrate with those in society in order to help our society meet kind of these goals?
So I think you're alluding to the fact that I've always described, I think, some of the challenges that we're facing, especially post-COVID, but it's a challenge that we've faced for a while, is the reality that the defense industrial base and really the industrial base writ large of the nation probably needs a reset, right? As we try to extend the capacity and capabilities of our ability to build things, part of the struggle is literally just getting the workforce that you need to be able to do those things. I think, you know, the thing that was pretty interesting to me is I get an opportunity in my current role as Commander of STRATCOM to visit a lot of different shipyards, visit Palmdale to see the B-21 being built, visit Roy, Utah, and Hill Air Force Base to see the work that's being done with the replacement of the Minuteman III. But every time, you know, you have those conversations with folks, they're like, we're trying to just get folks that know how to weld. We need folks that know how to lay concrete. You know, we need folks that understand what the term rebarb actually really means, as well as the STEM. Don't get me wrong. It's not that we don't need STEM professionals. We absolutely do with the technologies that we're seeing in the 21st century and continue to stay in leading edge in that regime. But at the same time, it's okay to be able to roll up your sleeves and do some of the work that the artisans are doing in the careers that I just mentioned. We need to do a better job of letting the men and women across the nation know that that is just as important. And we recognize you for those talents just as importantly as we would for sending you to a university to do the STEM type of work.
Yes, sir. And that speaks loudly to me as a prior enlisted mechanic. There's a culture at that level that very proud of what they do. Knowing how to pour the concrete or turn the wrench is such a valuable skill, both out of service and our enlisted force in the service. So I got the final question, sir. Is there anything else that you would like to discuss?
One thing that's pretty unique about the men and women of our services is it's an all-volunteer force. And to be frank, our allies are grateful with the work and partners are grateful with the work that we provide and the relationships that we have, even at the lowest levels. And our allies and partners continue to reference us each and every day on the work that we do and the talents that you guys show. Our adversaries are envious and scared to death of you. And all I ask is that let's make sure they continue to be scared to death of you.
Sir, thank you so much for coming. It's, again, humbling to have somebody with your many responsibilities come in and take time to speak to us. This last question, I would like to focus on more than just your current job and leverage your many years of experience doing this. We talked a little bit about the change, being uncomfortable. And so the question is simply, what advice do you have for our leaders as they do their part to meet the challenges before us?
Yeah, so you know, I came up with a saying when I was a wing commander way back in 2009, and I call it Cotton's Four C's. And for those who worked for me even here at Air University, they heard it as well. The first C is you need to be competent. And this is in uniform and out of uniform, but very simple. I'm an NC State grad, I make things simple. Be competent in the job that you're in. Be committed in everything that you do. Because if you don't have commitment, guess what? You're probably not going to be competent. We talked a little bit about the challenges that we're going to see and the tension on the string. Have composure. There's going to be times when things get worse before they get better. Be composed as we go through it. People are looking at you, especially folks in leadership roles. They're looking at you to see how you're taking things. Are you composed about it? Are you freaking out? How are you engaged in that dilemma? And then the fourth one, and to be frank, the most important one to me is compassion, compassionate leadership. Do you show empathy? That does not mean that you do not hold people accountable. Hold people accountable, but show compassion. Competence, commitment, composure, compassion. And I'll leave you with that.
That's going to do it for this week's podcast. The show is recorded, edited, and produced by the LeMay Center's Doctrine Outreach section. Special thanks to General Cotton, the STRATCOM PA staff, the LeMay Center, and Air University. As always, the views expressed by our panel members are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of Air University, the Air Force, or any government agency. I'm Nicholas Underwood. We will see you next time.